Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. More than 80 years after American women won the right to vote, gender representation in U.S. politics is anything but 50-50. Women now hold 59 of the 435 seats in the House of Representatives, 14 of the 100 seats in the Senate. They hold the governorships of 7 states. One is running for the highest political office in the land. It's time to take the men-only sign off the White House door, said Democrat Carol Mosley Braun in February, officially entering the 2004 presidential race. But even with a Hillary Clinton in the wings, the prospect of a Ms. President can still seem perpetually elusive, and a politics equally influenced by women a dream. But why? The story of the women's suffrage movement itself may offer clues. Tonight on Point, the female factor in American politics, then and now. What difference did the sacrifices of the suffragists make for American democracy, for you? And if women ran the show, would America, would the world be a different place or not? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Joining me now from Washington is Eleanor Clift, contributing editor for Newsweek magazine and author of the new book, Founding Sisters and the 19th Amendment. Good evening and welcome, Eleanor Clift.
Good evening, Tom. I'm glad to be with you.
It's great to have you. So here you are, Eleanor. You've waded into all the stories and the richness of the long ago and very long campaign for the women's vote in America. And we want to learn and relearn a lot about that tonight. But before we dive into the history, Eleanor, I wonder if you'd just give us your snapshot. You've had a front row seat in Washington for a long time. You call your own arrival in Washington as a reporter a kind of Cinderella story that a kind of accidental feminism that got you there. But what's your sense of American women's influence in American politics right now? There are, I guess, more women than men in this country. How do you see the imprint of women, their presence and their electoral imprint? Is it distinguishable? Is it distinct?
Well, women are the crown jewel of the electorate. And if you watch the presidential candidates, they are courting the female vote. President Bush is airing attack ads against the Democrats, saying that they're going after him because he's going after terrorists. Well, that commercial is really aimed at women and trying to reassure women that the president's policies are making them safer. So I think women are the swing vote in this country.
They may be the swing vote, but as you sit in Washington and you look at the politics there, well, we just read off the numbers on Capitol Hill. Does it still feel overwhelmingly masculine, or have even those numbers, 40-some and 14, made a difference on Capitol Hill?
Well, women are the swing vote in this country, but we are not monolithic. And I think the barriers to running for higher office still exist. And being a political candidate for any level of office is a daunting task, and women are still the primary caretakers of families. Women haven't yet built the Rolodexes that allow them access to the kind of money that you need to run for political office, although Howard Dean's success with the Internet, I think, opens up a new path for women in the future. So I think also, the other opportunities that women have now in professional life, I think, offer them so many alternatives that running for political office, where you have to expose your family to scrutiny, where you have to make your tax returns public, I think that puts off women. And there's also a phenomenon among women where they somehow think that politics are dirty, and once politics are cleaned up, maybe they'll get involved.
When you sit with women in power in Washington these days, Eleanor Clift, do you hear them, the members of the House of Representatives, the female members of the Senate, do they talk about, oh, boy, it's such a boys' club here, or are they past that?
I think you still hear that kind of conversation, and you also hear frustration with how the media cover female candidates. And in a book that I co-authored with my husband that came out initially in the year 2000, we quoted Senator Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas saying in frustration that no matter what she says, if she has a run in her stockings, that's what everybody will notice. So, and I think women grapple with the fact that their clothes and their hair attract so much attention. Hillary Clinton's hairdos from day to day has probably gotten more coverage than many of her political stands. And so I think because women are still in the minority in public life, those kinds of issues tend to dominate.
Now, having just read through your new book, Founding Sisters, a lot of these things are resonating with me. Throughout this hour, we want to keep that contemporary situation in mind as we look back at the history that kind of laid the table. Maybe a real short course, Eleanor, if you'd be good enough to remind people how this movement got started, how long it took, and very quickly how it came to culmination, just so we can capsulize that before we get into the detail.
Well, you can go all the way back to Abigail Adams writing to her husband, John Adams, at the Constitutional Convention, urging him to remember the ladies.
Remember the ladies.
Yes, and he was very dismissive of her yearnings. But the official start, I think, of the suffrage movement is 1848, when a group of women in Seneca Falls, New York, put a little notice in the newspaper that there would be a women's convention in the local chapel, and 300 people showed up, including a lot of men.
This was Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia
Mott. She was the primary mover, yes. Mm-hmm. And they passed a Declaration of Sentiments, which was really modeled after the Declaration of Independence. And it was gender neutral in its language, and it did call for women to have the right to vote, which was the only plank in that declaration that didn't pass unanimously because it was such a radical notion that women would vote in 1848.
That is hard now to even comprehend. What was it about the American culture in 1848 that made that incomprehensible?
Well, life was divided into two spheres, the public sphere and the private sphere, and women were the lord and master of the home, and men conducted public life. And in those early years, being lord and master of the home was really a full-time job. Mm-hmm. And the suffrage movement really didn't gain steam until the country began to industrialize and kitchens got modernized, and a woman could be freed from some of the chores of daily life.
Are you saying that women even themselves thought, I have too many chores, I can't be involved? Or what did women feel?
I mean, well, I think they literally, if they fell down on the job, the household would collapse. And now, of course, there were wealthy women who had servants, so it was certainly more than just being tied to the chores. It was how we looked upon how life should be ordered. And it was only the radical few who questioned that. And for much of the 72 years before women did get the vote in 1920, the majority of women were not particularly interested in getting the vote. They enjoyed being on what they thought was a pedestal at home. They were fearful of public responsibility. And many were openly hostile to getting the vote. And so you have to get your head around the fact that women voting was so radical for much of this period. And until really after the Civil War and getting towards the turn of the century, again, with the industrialization of the country, mm-hmm. that the notion that women should participate in public life began to make more sense because more women were actually going out and working. And the rules of society said you were the property of your father until you left home, then you were the property of your husband, and you really didn't even have a right to keep your earnings if you were a school teacher or a factory worker. And so to change that was all part of the suffrage movement as well.
Let's trek that forward a century or so. Do you still see echoes of that initial reluctance, maybe just from lack of habit on the part of women to engage with public life, with the hurly-burly? Does that still have some trace?
I think you can still see a hangover from that. I mean, women are much more reluctant, for example, to write a check on their own to a political candidate. And I know Pat Schroeder, who was a long-serving member of the House until she retired a few years ago, would talk about hearing her husband on the phone, and somebody he knew would call up and say, well, I'm raising money for this. And her husband would say, well, I'm raising money for this or that charity. And she said they would exchange checks. And she said, you know, women, we just never did that. And she told of being followed into the parking lot one night after she had given a speech by a very well-dressed woman who, you know, said how much she admired her and really wanted to help her and pressed a check into her hands. And Pat Schroeder thought it would surely be a significant amount. It was for $10. And so, yeah, I mean, I think you see still somewhat of a reluctance on the part of women to fully engage in the responsibilities of public life.
Looking back to that 72-year campaign to get the vote for women, what was it that ultimately turned, what were the thought lines that ultimately turned the country's thinking around?
Well, I think it took a lot of confrontation in Washington, and the tail end of the suffrage movement really is the model for the other social movements of the 20th century that followed. Civil rights, certainly, the modern women's movement of the 1970s, of which I'm a beneficiary, and also the protests during the Vietnam era. Alice Paul, a name most people are not familiar with, she was a young Quaker woman with a degree from Swarthmore and a Ph.D. from the University of Pennsylvania. And she had gone to London to study social work. And she came under the influence of the radical feminists in Britain who were working in the London slums. And she was arrested in London and really radicalized there. And when she came back to America in 1910, she was shocked that the suffrage movement in this country had become so sedate and really just had settled into the American scene. The suffragists were invited to the White House. They were toasted at various ceremonies. They were treated rather grandly. Everything happened just wonderfully, except they didn't get the vote. Mm-hmm. And she determined that confrontation would be necessary, and she stood up to the established suffragists and organized a protest at Woodrow Wilson's inauguration in 1913. And when the president-elect arrived at Union Station in Washington, he wondered where all the crowds were to greet him, and he told they were over on the avenue watching the ladies, which was Pennsylvania Avenue. And she had orchestrated a grand parade with 8,000 women, women in nurses' uniforms, women in academic gowns, factory workers. There were floats and marching bands, and leading the parade was the most beautiful suffragist ever, which is how she was written about, a woman named Inez Milholland Wasserwein, and she rode a white horse. It was grand.
Oh, my.
But lining the avenue were men who didn't like this evolution of the social order, and they were jeering and tripping the women and throwing lighted cigarette butts. And there was quite a bit of violence ensued. And the next day's headline said 300 suffragists hurt in parade. And Alice Paul, initially her elders in the movement, were horrified that violence had befallen them. And this young woman, Alice Paul, said, no, this is good. We were on the front pages for the first time in a long time. We've got the sympathy of the country. And so she developed the strategy of protest and confrontation that after almost the full two terms of Woodrow Wilson's presidency finally convinced him to press for suffrage as a war measure. Remember, this is in the shadow of World War
I. Yes.
And to turn the Congress to vote the 19th Amendment. But I was horrified myself to discover how much violence went on and the humiliation and the hardship that these women had to endure before the government acknowledged their rights.
We'll look back at some more of that, but I note that you quote Democrat James Cox saying when the 19th Amendment went through, the civilization of the world is saved. There were some who thought this would be it. Mothers will check war. That is, mothers will, I guess, put an end to war was a headline.
That's right. And a lot of women from the suffragist movement evolved into the peace movement. And I think for a long time, and you still see that today, there's this notion that women will be a civilizing influence in politics, that we will clean it up, that we're somehow better or more moral. I wish that were the case, but I really can't cite a lot of evidence for that.
Eleanor Clift, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking with Newsweek contributing editor Eleanor Clift. Her new book is Founding Sisters in the 19th Amendment. We're looking at the female factor in American politics then and now. You can join the conversation a century on. Do you understand why the battle to win women the vote was so difficult? Have women with the vote changed America? How? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the female factor in American politics, then and now. My guest is Eleanor Clift. She's contributing editor at Newsweek magazine and author of the new book, Founding Sisters, and the 19th Amendment. You can join the conversation tonight. Why still no female American president or vice president? Do you expect to see a woman in the Oval Office in your lifetime? How soon and who? And if women ran the roost, would the country be different or not? Is it different already with Condoleezza Rice, Madeleine Albright, Hillary Clinton, and more? Deborah's calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, Deborah. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I actually kind of take issue with a couple of things that were said on the air. First, that mostly women are looked at for their hairdos. I don't see that at all when we speak about Madeleine Albright or Condoleezza Rice or many other people who are women in politics who think on their feet. They have their head about them. They have a good sense of what they're doing and their purpose. And I think that it's your thought that matters. And I think that if your thought is good and if your actions are good, that your hairdo means nothing. You know, it's not paid attention to whatsoever.
We've got it, Deborah. And your second point?
Second point is that women during the time of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, she was saying something about the idea that they ran the household, and I also take issue with that women during that time hardly could own their own clothes. The children they gave birth to they didn't own their children.
You're saying they didn't even have the clout to run the household? Is that your point?
They didn't have the clout to run the household. They were more in a position of almost servitude to the house and to the man. The man was the ruler of the home and everything else. And women, even to this day, really don't have equal rights. But I think that the women in the United States have worked hard and have maintained a strength of purpose enough to bring about a unsaid equal right.
An unsaid equal right. You mean you see this kind of emerging despite everything?
Despite everything, I think women have are gaining equal rights, and I think they're an example for many other nations. I think that in democracy, the women that are now taking jobs, holding jobs, and holding their own, managing their families, as well as volunteer jobs, and 7 days, 6 days, whatever you want to call it, work week, I think that they're proving their ability to work, maintain their homes, and demand equal rights.
No question, they're carrying a big load. Deborah, thank you for your call. Eleanor Clift, what about it? Deborah says, hey, let's get over this run in the nylons problem. It doesn't really hold the day anymore.
Well, I don't think I disagree with her, but if you talk to any woman in public life, they will tell you that they still get more observation about matters that they think are trivial than they think men get paid attention to. If you look at Elizabeth Dole's presidential run in 2000 and how she was covered and the amount of space devoted to her hair and the color of her suits and so forth.
I guess John Edwards gets some grief for his
pretty boy. I certainly agree that Condoleezza Rice and Madeleine Albright and Hillary Clinton and everybody else are out there with their ideas. I don't think we're saying anything any different from each other, frankly.
And what about the idea that women were actually so subjugated in the mid-18th, 19th century that they didn't even run the home? Do you buy that from your research?
Well, I made the point that you were the possession of your father until you married, and then you were the possession of your husband. And women who didn't marry, like Susan B. Anthony, who went out and earned her living as a school teacher, were allowed to be more independent simply because they were not under somebody else's roof. But when I said women ran the household, I mean, they were allowed to do all the chores, and they had the full responsibility of running the house and taking care of the children. But they certainly didn't have the kind of responsibility and that we think of today. So, again, I don't think I'm saying anything different from the caller.
Well, the women at that first meeting you described in Seneca Falls, New York, were derided later in a newspaper column there as divorced wives, childless women, and some old maids. Clearly, mocking meant to hurt. But was there some truth in was it women outside the kind of housekeeping mainstream who first took up the torch for women's suffrage?
Well, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was the mother of seven children, so she was
not
certainly very much in the domestic mainstream. I think if you look in the latter period of time, the women who succeeded Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, their successors, Alice Paul and Carrie Chapman Catt, Cat married twice, but I don't believe she had children, and Alice Paul did not marry. So I think women who did devote themselves more to being activists probably found it very difficult to also have a married life and also to have children. Again, a phenomenon we see today. I mean, it's relatively recent that women who go into professional careers feel that they can also have children and can somehow figure out how to balance that. If you go back not too long ago to the women who made it to the top, certainly in business, you're not going to find a lot of them with families.
Eleanor, take us to 1920 and that final vote that pushed through the 19th Amendment. There were some really dramatic moments there. Was it clear as this got pushed forward that it was going to happen? And there was a final cliffhanger vote that came down to the vote of one man.
Yes, but I also I can't skip over the fact that Alice Paul and the women who protested in front of the White House were jailed and went on a hunger strike and were force-fed, and there was a horrific period there. And Alice Paul at one point was confined at St. Elizabeth, which is a mental hospital.
This was in the 19-teens, is that right?
Exactly, 1918. Mm-hmm. And she was held for allegedly having an unhealthy obsession with President Wilson. And these events are so dramatic. And here I'm going to put in a plug there. HBO is doing a feature film on this specific era of the suffrage movement, the Alice Paul confrontations and the jailings.
The last
and so
years
forth.
There.
With Hilary Swank, the rather well-known, accomplished actress, playing Alice Paul. And that will debut this coming February, along with Susan B. Anthony's birthday on February 15th,
so
following
we'll
get to see it all acted
out.
Following the last episode of Sex and the City on HBO. So I want
Such
your audience to know that we're taking the suffragists out of the closet and out of the history books and making them accessible to young women, but to everybody today. But to get to your question about after all of this drama, the jailings and the confrontations and the embarrassment for President Wilson, who's a wartime president, the amendment goes through the ratification process, and 36 states had to ratify it. And it came down to the last state of Tennessee, which was a southern state not particularly sympathetic to suffrage, came down to a tie vote in the House. And that meant the measure would be tabled and it would have died and the process would have had to be started again. When a young man changed his vote at the last minute, Harry Byrne, he was the youngest member
Montana.
Of the legislature, 24, and he said he changed his vote because he'd gotten a telegram from his mother that morning urging him to be a good boy and support ratification. So you almost can't make this up.
On the mother's urging, it goes over the edge.
That's right. That's right. And young Mr. Byrne did manage to get reelected, but he needed a bodyguard when he went home to his rural community of Mouse Creek, Tennessee, pointing up that this was still controversial.
I guess it was. We're talking about the female factor in American politics. Arthur's calling from Kalkaska, Michigan. Hi, Arthur. You're on the air.
Yeah, good evening. You've got the name right, Kalkaska.
Great.
And, it's pretty cold up here tonight, and we have a winter storm.
Hunker down, Arthur.
But anyway, I just wanted to say hello to Eleanor Clift, because I really respect her opinions on the McLaughlin Group, which I watch every Sunday.
Thank you.
And especially, I guess it's because what she has to say matches my point of view most of the time. I don't feel that the group, especially John McLaughlin, I don't feel that he doesn't give her the opportunity. He usually speaks over her or cuts into what she's saying, and the other men on the group seem to be disrespectful. Can you give me your feelings on that, Eleanor, as to how you feel you're treated on the McLaughlin group?
Ooh, now we get personal. what about that macho maelstrom that you're part of there,
Eleanor? Well, I like to say that as the lone woman typically on that show being bullied by the men, I think that's why I relate to the suffragists and also to modern women in politics who also are few in number and have to fight to be heard. But I think I've lasted on the McLaughlin group as long as I have because I'm a good sport and they may poke me around a bit. But I usually land a few punches of my own. And I figure that if I can get in there with my point of view and make it crisp, and at least I'm giving them as good as they give me some of the time.
But Arthur raises an interesting point, Eleanor, about the quality of discourse, the texture of discourse in Washington, and maybe the McLaughlin group is an exaggerated form. Maybe it's not. Is there something just kind of baked in, macho chest thumping about Washington that, I don't know, that crimps the female input, or that begs to be changed by women in Washington, or is that too simplistic?
Well, I would like to think that if the Senate were 86 women and 14 men, that maybe the hours would be more civilized. Maybe they would get their work done, and maybe we'd have a rational system of daycare in this country, and teachers and nurses would get paid more. So, yeah, I think if women were in greater numbers, if they reached more critical mass in places of power, that we would see some difference. But I think it's dangerous to think that women are better than. I think we're different than in some areas. And I think if you had a McLaughlin group, say, with, you know, four women and one man, I shudder to think what that would be like, actually, because I don't know if that would be any better.
Arthur, what do you think? Would you tune in for that? And what do you think about Eleanor's role there as a kind of, you know, mini version of Washington writ large?
Yeah, I like her on the role. I feel that she does well with the group. She has a wealth of knowledge and opinion, and I appreciate her taking a stand on a lot of these issues. And her counterpoint appears to be Tony. I don't know if she feels the same way about that. I can't remember his last name. But anyway,
Tony Blankley. Yes.
Tony Blankley. You appear to be like plus and minus against each other.
Yeah, well, Tony used to be Newt Gingrich's press secretary when Gingrich was speaker and on his ascendancy to speaker. And actually, Tony was a pretty good source for me. I mean, I'm a reporter by training. And so I've known Tony for a long time. We do come at most issues from an opposite viewpoint. Mm. I am a reporter by nature, and I do try to back up my opinions with some facts. And I think Tony is now the editor of the editorial page of the Washington Times, which is a conservative newspaper here in town. Yes. Mm. And he also tries to back up his positions with facts. And the stunning thing about Washington is that two people can look at the same set of information and come to such radically different conclusions. And
we've seen that.
We really are yin and yang in this city.
There's the microcosm. Arthur, thanks for your call. Lee's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Lee. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to say that I think that I'm very hopeful that women will take a greater portion in politics in other areas. If you're in business, as I am, and you're looking to hire, You want to be hiring from the broadest possible pool of talent,
mm-hmm.
and to cut yourself off from a particularly talented group it doesn't make any sense in business, and it shouldn't make any sense in politics. Another thing that that I wanted to point out is that I'd seen a while back a story on 60 Minutes. It was really a story about Saudi Arabia, and they were interviewing these girls in school there,
right.
and asking them about their about what their feelings were about education, about taking part in government. And it's startling, and it's disappointing, and it's suffrage in as you explained earlier in microcosm there, because they felt that this young girl who was being interviewed said that she and her friends believed that men were better to run the country.
But what should we take from that, Lee? Do you think that's still at work in the United States today, or that's a distant, in this case, Saudi phenomenon?
I think it's at work in the United States, but I'm hopeful that people in my age group, in their late 40s and early 50s, are starting to come into our own and understanding that we can't hope for a better future if we don't
fully engage that half the ledger. Lee, we've got it, and thank you very much for your call. Eleanor Clift, how about that? Do you see a generational change flowing through Washington? Is the openness greater in different decades of Americans represented there or not?
I think young women coming of age today take a lot of what they see as equality for granted. And I think one of the reasons that I was interested in doing this book, that I want to remind people how hard fought even the simple act of the right to vote has been in this country.
But does taking that for granted push them ahead, or does it hold them back?
No, it doesn't. And they have the luxury of not even bothering to vote, but that doesn't push them ahead. And in fact, you can see stories today about women retreating more to the safety of the home now that they have this choice. And I certainly would applaud the fact that we have this choice, but you don't want to forfeit your right in the public arena simply because it looks too hard, too difficult.
Does that mean, are you saying then that younger people in Washington, younger women in particular, are not more confident of their position and opportunities, but perhaps even less?
I think it's very individual, and mm-hmm. I think you can find little girls in the third grade who say they want to grow up to be president or secretary of state or national security advisor, because all those things now seem possible because they do see role models. But I also think you see a constant backlash to the advance of women in society and a tug and pull toward the home, which in part is hormonal and natural, especially if there are children involved. But I think it's also part of the hangover from this is man's work and this is women's work, and women in politics in particular have to often be invited into the process. They don't really think of themselves as political candidates, whereas you tap a man and suggest running for office and his reaction is, why did you wait so long?
Off to the races. Eleanor Clift,
right.
Stand by. We're talking about the female factor in American politics then and now. Eleanor Clift's new book is Founding Sisters in the 19th Amendment. You can join the conversation. Why do you think so many American women did not want the vote? Does that attitude still echo somewhere in American politics today? Listeners, get into the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the female factor in American politics then and now. Tonight, my guest is Eleanor Clift. She's author of the new book, Founding Sisters and the 19th Amendment. Why isn't half the U.S. Congress female today? Do your daughters know the history of the women's suffrage movement? Do your sons? Did you know the sacrifices that were made for the women's right to vote? Sheila's calling from Boston. Hi, Sheila. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Ms. Clift if her research for the book indicated what the role of African-American women was in the struggle for the vote.
Well, it absolutely does, starting with Sojourner Truth, and, of course, her great 1851 speech where she asked, "Ain't I a woman?" And Eleanor Clift held herself up as an example of a woman who was no delicate flower.
Right. Sojourner Truth was born in the 1790s a slave. She later escaped and did win her legal freedom. And she was a great ally of the women's movement. And she was over 6 feet tall and well-muscled from having worked in the fields. And when she would speak at these rallies, pretty soon word spread that maybe she was really a man because she was so strong. And at one rally, she bared her breasts and dared any of the suspicious audience to come and check her out if they wished. So she was quite a bold woman. And during the Civil War and the lead up to the Civil War, she traveled around the North at pro-Union rallies, and she would dress in red, white, and blue to support the president and the Union. But the race issue is threaded throughout the suffrage movement, and it's often not pretty. The early suffragists were abolitionists, but the later suffragists did make various accommodations in order to win the votes of Southern white legislators.
Such as?
Susan B. Anthony asked Frederick Douglass not to attend a women's convention in Atlanta for fear of offending the Southern attendees. And Douglass had been at the very first convention in 1848, and he was a strong supporter of women's rights. And he believed that the right to vote was essential, and from that right, all other rights flowed. And he was one of the stalwart supporters of suffrage, even after he was rebuffed. And Ida Wells Barnett, a journalist in Illinois who was an anti-lynching crusader, she was a black woman. When Alice Paul organized this protest parade at Wilson's inauguration, Barnett attended, and Paul wanted her to march in the back. She had black women marching in the back of the parade.
And this was all the real politic of getting the Southern votes in for the amendment?
Well, yes. And that's what it was about. And it's hard to look into the hearts of these women and say, well, I'd like to believe that they didn't have these racist impulses and it was purely a pragmatic decision. But a pragmatic decision they made nonetheless. And Ida Wells Barnett actually waited on the side of the parade route, and when she saw the state of Illinois marchers go by, she just slipped in and marched with them. And in the HBO movie I talked about, they do have that scene, and they have Alice Paul smiling when she sees her ducking into the parade, as though telling us in the audience that Alice Paul really didn't want to be a racist.
That's the telegraphing, but who knows? Sheila, have you followed
who
this
knows?
Issue?
Who knows?
Well, you know what I'm wondering? Was there a parallel organization of African-American women at that time organizing for rights, or was the whole race issue so tight and tough during that era that, we couldn't
organize
at that time, that, you know, we were just, you know, subsumed in the larger organization of women's rights.
There were some of the northern states, there were separate chapters of black suffragists, and Susan B. Anthony really didn't want them in the main organization. And you have to remember, after the Civil War, black men, the freed black slaves, got the right to vote, and so the southern states, which quickly retreated into Jim Crow segregation, mm-hmm. they did their best to retake the vote. The last thing they wanted was to extend the vote in their views. They saw it as extending it to black women and sort of doubling their problem, which is how they saw it.
Sheila, thanks for your call. Sorry, Eleanor. I want to get a couple
more
calls.
Now I was just going to say it's a very difficult period, obviously.
Yeah, obviously on both sides, all sides. Jim's calling from Mansfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just want to throw a couple of comments out there. See if I get your feedback on.
Sure.
I don't know if it will make the discourse.
Toss them away, Jim. Toss them away.
I'd just like to get Eleanor's comments on what she feels is the current political economy of obviously, since women have the right to vote for some time, they certainly are actually the majority of the voting population statistically. Why women aren't seeking to make issues like selective service gender neutral?
Are you saying what are you getting at with that, Jim?
Well, women are not required to register for the draft.
Are you making a charge here? Are you saying women are ducking responsibility?
I'm just asking for comment. I mean.
But is that the gist of what you're saying?
You don't hear any women in the political arena asking for that. I mean, why is that issue, you know, such a like a sacred cow? If women are to have equal rights, which they're entitled to, then shouldn't they have equal responsibility?
Okay. Jim, thanks for your call, Eleanor.
Yeah, I remember the fight over the modern Equal Rights Amendment and how that broke down into divisions over whether, one, women and men would use unisex bathrooms, and two, whether women would be forced into combat in the military. I mean, that is – it's a highly divisive issue, not only among men but also among women. I suspect you could get easily the votes of women in this country for a universal service commitment, not necessarily to go into the armed forces, but to serve your country in some aspect. And I suspect that would be very popular. But I think a selective service to sign up for the military like they have in some countries, notably Israel, I think would not pass in this country. And frankly, right now, to have a draft in this country would be highly unpopular, although you could argue that we could use the manpower, the people power, but it's unpopular politically.
Heaven knows women have been very high profile in Iraq. Let's get one more call. Paul's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Eleanor. I try not to watch the McLaughlin group, but sometimes I can't help myself. but I just a comment, and it goes back to something that you were saying earlier about political discourse. And that is, it's generally well known that women are achieve more academically than men. And if college admissions were strictly based on academic achievement, there would be far more women in colleges than there are men. And I teach college, and I often think when I have students write papers that the women are far better than the men at making an argument, giving reasons for the argument, and kind of backing it up, whereas the men are much more likely to say, this is what I think because.
So what question or conclusion jumps off that, Paul?
Well, I think that we'd be a lot better off if more women were in politics and if those numbers were reversed, 86 women and 14 men. I mean, I am by no means a lefty, but it's one of those things that the more experience I have with college students, the more I think we'd be much better off. And I just wanted to kind of press you. You had kind of joked a little earlier that may not be the case, and I think it might be.
Oh, let's pick it up. Paul, thanks for your call. Eleanor.
Well, I think women do have a different style of communication. We do try to get to consensus, I think, whereas men seem to one-up each other more. I certainly see that on the McLaughlin group. When I first started doing the show, I felt really like I was in alien territory because interrupting and, as my husband puts it, towel snapping is really not a comfortable style of conversation for me. I've learned how to interrupt, but they still interrupt me after I get about two sentences out. But, you know, I think women, if we were more in control in this country, we bring a different set of life experiences. I think we would be more sensitive towards family issues, children issues. And I don't think we would let down on national security because women, above all, want to be safe. And so, I mean, I'd love it if we gave female power a turn in this country, but I think that's going to be very gradual. And before we reach parity on Capitol Hill, it could be, at the rate we're going, another 200 years.
Well, we will all stay tuned, even if it's 200 years. Eleanor Cliff, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Eleanor Cliff's new book is Founding Sisters. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mitra Kalita's parents immigrated to the United States in the early 1970s. Her father, a high-ranking mining engineer in India, took a job as a filing clerk in New York. Her mother worked at a Burger King. They struggled initially, but then began to taste the American dream. They bought a house in 1978 in Massapequa, Long Island. Mitra's father became an executive at Citibank. In her new book, Suburban Sahibs, Three Immigrant Families and Their Passage from India to America, Mitra Kalita, an education reporter at The Washington Post, draws on her experience to write about Indian immigrant families. Here she reads a passage from her book.
The passage that I'm going to read from is the prologue to the book, which describes a festival that Indians put on in central New Jersey every year. The festival grew out of an auditorium in a high school where just a few dozen Indians used to gather every year, and now it's grown to attract thousands for 4 weekends every October, and is really a sign of how a community has come to define their new home in New Jersey. The festival celebrates an Indian holiday known as Navratri. It's a festival that commemorates good's conquest of evil, and there's a lot of dancing, and there's a prayer ceremony that's done in the middle of the night. It's been a controversial festival in New Jersey because it does take place for much of the night, keeping up some of the neighbors. Under a canopy tent, thousands step and twirl and skip and sink, silks flailing, skirts swishing, jeans scraping. Bare, pedicured, bejeweled feet alongside Nikes and Timberlands hit the carpet for just a moment before the next step takes over, picking up speed with each beat of the drums and the melodious sounds and high pitches of home. Here in suburban New Jersey, the 7-Eleven cashier and Amoco gas station attendant become dancing kings with whom bankers and computer programmers struggle to keep pace. It is the night of October 7, 2000, one of the nights of Navratri, a Hindu festival commemorating good's conquest of evil. The tent's canvas walls encompass a heated area 3 times the size of a football field, but can't keep the crowds within from shivering or blowing clouds as they breathe and speak. The teenagers with their North Face puffy jackets keep them on as they dance, brown faces eventually dripping with sweat, arms pumping out of the thick material of their outerwear. To stay warm, the others also dance fast or sip chai sold at stalls manned by mustachioed men and hair-netted women. For a moment, those who left India may feel they never really did, from the wives who followed their husbands' dreams, to the educated who learned to make donuts and count change in nickels and dimes, to the children who search for the scent of grandmother's sandalwood soap in the faint, faded foreign words of a blue aerogram. Tonight, they transport themselves back to those festival nights, when Papa carried them home and sleep was so sound, they didn't feel the scratch of the mosquito net against their bare legs as Ma erected it around the bed they shared. She remembers laughing at the neighbor's son as he brought her a cup of sugarcane juice seasoned with salt and spices in between dances. He remembers the tough talk of teenagers, his first smoke, and a resolve to outdream the others. Underneath the tent, they relive those moments, taste them, see them, hear them, remember. Beyond the tent's walls lies the evidence of newly forged frontiers. Steps away, a parking lot filled with Toyota Camrys and Honda Accords and sport utility vehicles. Yards away, the entrance to the New Jersey Turnpike. Miles away, houses equipped with central heating and air conditioning, 3-car garages or perhaps none. Mortgages or dreams of qualifying for one. Student loans, credit card debt, home as they know it now. Half a world away from the home they knew then.
Mitra Kalita reading from her new book, Suburban Sahibs, Three Immigrant Families and Their Passage from India to America. Kalita is an education reporter at The Washington Post. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.